Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is March 15th, which means that 1 year ago today, Governor Baker ordered schools across the state to close. He suspended indoor dining and banned gatherings of 24 or more people. At that time, we had no idea what the next 365 days would bring. We were thinking in terms of weeks then, not a year. But it's been a year. And during that time, we've talked to a range of people affected by the shutdowns, especially early on. So as we begin to reemerge, we hope, into some new normal now, we want to check back in with some of them. And today we'll do that, including a grocery store worker, a home health aide, a restaurateur. But first, let's check in with the T, which kept running, shuttled healthcare, frontline essential workers to and from work, but also just enacted another round of service cuts yesterday. Listeners, we're going to invite you to join the conversation all hour, again, starting with the T. Do you have memories of riding the T at the beginning of the pandemic? Have you been riding it the whole time? And if so, have you felt safe? And if you haven't been riding it, are you starting to plan some return to your old T commute? Maybe you have concerns about the recent round of service cuts. We'll take your calls at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us again now is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek. Steve, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Steve, we got a lot to cover in our time, the most recent service cuts, budget outlook going into the future, but I really want to start by looking back. I want to go back in time with you to this time last year. We marked the one-year anniversary of the state of emergency last week. This week, we started to see the wide-scale shutdowns. Is there a moment for you last year when you realized what a big deal this was going to be, or at least had your first inkling? Do you remember a specific moment when it really hit you?
I do remember. For me, it was, I had attended a meeting in the governor's office on March 4th of last year, where we got a high-level briefing from folks who have become household names now, Mary Lou Sutters, Paul Buttinger from MVH, and they had talked about, you know, what was potentially going to happen. And then we went out and did a press conference, and I remember about half of the questions in the press conference were directed at me about, you know, what kind of cleaning protocols are going to be put in place, what are you going to do? And I think it was that moment, you know, I began to feel like this was a big wave, and it was going to break right on top of all of us.
When you look back on that now, I guess I'll ask it this way. Is there anything you wish you could say to yourself in March of 2020?
Back then, yes, buy masks, buy hand sanitizer, right? We did not, like almost everybody else, we did not have that. And when when we started to try to get it, everybody else wanted it at the same time. And in fact, we were reduced at one point. We couldn't get hand sanitizer to give out to our employees. So we ended up buying huge 256-gallon drums of hand sanitizer and having employees. We were able to buy little squirt bottles and having employees manually fill the bottles so that we could give our employees hand sanitizer.
So I want to pick up on the mask thing, too. I mean, last spring, we got mixed messages about masks for a while. You've been coming on, checking in with us regularly. Last May, we talked about mask enforcement on the T. And at that time, the science wasn't as clear on masks. You said at the time you were reluctant about enforcing mask wearing, especially because people with disabilities, for example, couldn't wear the masks. You didn't want to put T operators on the spot. We know so much now that we didn't know then. Do you wish you had more strictly enforced mask wearing earlier, and could you have?
I think the practicality of enforcing it from a kind of a law enforcement perspective is very difficult. We have been enforcing it with our own employees. We have suspended some employees who were not wearing masks. We have tried, I think, to take a more supportive approach where we are doing audits both of customers and of employees, targeting those areas with poor levels of compliance, not only with education, but providing them with masks. So, you know, I think, you know, we have tried to push it as much as we can, and also given some latitude, you know, if drivers see someone without a mask, they can call it in and the transit police will respond. But I think, you know, our initial approach has always been to try to take a more kind of supportive, corrective approach as opposed to a legal enforcement approach.
I just want to take a minute to invite listeners to the conversation, 800-423-8255. Have you been riding the T all along? If not, when do you plan to return to the T? Do you have concerns about or were you affected by service cuts? How essential is the T and public transportation for your work? Again, 800-423-8255. So, Steve, if we sort of think about our conversation as looking back, looking at today, and then looking forward, I'm going to move us to today now. You're estimating a $400 million deficit per year over the next 5 years. You've implemented service cuts to address it, scale back in some cases, elimination in other cases, fewer service cuts than you originally intended. But the most recent round went into effect yesterday, including a 20% reduction on the red, orange, and green lines, blue line reduced by 5%. Bus routes consolidated, some eliminated. What are the reactions you've been hearing in the last 24 hours if those have gone into effect?
Yeah, I think it is service cuts are difficult. And obviously the folks who have been directly affected, you know, we're hearing from them. I do think it's important to note we are still running 88% of pre-COVID service. And in a bunch of places where we've retained ridership, on about 20 bus routes, we're actually running more service than we did pre-COVID. So I think, you know, we have worked very hard to sort of strategically realign resources to provide service where it's currently needed. And it is something we're going to track and follow, and we will adjust in the summer and fall as needed.
How does that work? How does the tracking and adjusting, especially, let's say, like the 55 bus, if it's not running, how do you know if people need it? So how do you know if it needs to come back online? Do you understand my question?
I do. And I think, you know, in some cases on some of these bus routes, particularly some that's serve major institutions, you know, we'll be in dialogue with those institutions. I know we're going to do that on the 52 bus route as well. Also, if we see ridership begin to increase sort of above the norm on some of the alternative services, in most cases, places where routes have been eliminated, in many cases, I should say, where routes have been eliminated, there's alternative service within a quarter mile. If we see ridership increase there, that will be another leading indicator.
Let's grab a call here, Steve, 800-423-8255. We've got Jennifer on the line in Jamaica Plain. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on with General Manager Steve Poftak of the MBTA.
Yes, I have lots of concerns about cutback in service. One of the big ones being that right now when I commute to Boston Medical Center on the number one bus, we are shoulder-to-shoulder tight. The orange line is also very busy at the time when I'm traveling. I've been vaccinated, but I know most of the people on that bus are not. I also have a disability, so I can never drive, and I can't even ride a bicycle anymore. So I need the T to get around.
Thanks for the call, Jennifer. Steve, do you want to respond to Jennifer?
Yes. And, you know, obviously, it's helpful to hear that. I would say, we are cutting back service, but incrementally, when you think about sort of the time between trains on the orange line. As for crowding on the number one bus, I don't know off the top of my head. Crowding is something we track very closely, and we also provide information to our customers in real time on how crowded the buses are. So that is something we will continue to track. I think, you know, one of our challenges is that we have a finite supply of buses, so we can't necessarily move them around. As I said before, we are providing more service, and I think the number one is one of those places we are providing more service than we did pre-COVID on 20 of our bus routes. And I believe the number one is one of those.
So, Steve, let's stay on this, and I'm going to give you some pushback that I know you're already familiar with, and I want to start with a note from Chris Dempsey, or a statement he made in Twitter. He's of the Transportation for Massachusetts, estimating that the cuts that the T has enacted will only save about $21 million this fiscal year. You're talking about year-over-year shortfalls of $400 million. Are those numbers right, that $21 million? And if so, given the pain of the cuts and how little of the deficit it makes up, why do it? Why not postpone until COVID relief money comes in?
That's $21 million through this fiscal year. So, considering that, the cuts, the initial round of cuts went into effect in January and another went into effect today, I do think that's a meaningful amount of money. I think what we're trying to do is preserve as much, and we've worked very hard this year to preserve as much money to fund us through FY22 and 23. And I think we now have a pathway to funding the budget deficit through those years to allow us to adjust. What we need is time to figure out what the new ridership is going to look like as folks come back, or folks maybe don't come back or only come back intermittently. And I think what we're trying to do is steward the system in a way that we can make those adjustments because as you mentioned in the intro, when you look at our projected budgets through the middle part of this decade, we're looking at, depending on your level of optimism about fares, of budget deficits, structural budget deficits between 300 and 500 million.
So you probably heard that Congressman Stephen Lynch made some remarks this morning. So let me backtrack. There is an estimated shy of $1 billion, but maybe $900 million in relief from the American Rescue Plan that could come towards the T. I've seen estimates for between $700 million and $900 million. Congressman Stephen Lynch spoke out harshly this morning about the service cuts, saying that they were against the spirit of the American Rescue Plan. He was at an event with Marty Walsh, Boston mayor. I want to play a little bit of it for you. Here he is.
So we pushed this money out to the MBTA for the purpose of providing services and keeping people employed. And now they get $1 billion and they're going to take the $1 billion and lay people off? I don't think so. Or they're going to take the $1 billion and then leave people stranded? That doesn't work for us as a delegation, as a Massachusetts delegation. I've talked to my colleagues, and they are furious about this.
And I should note that the commuter rail operator Keolis has decided to furlough 40 employees, which is the layoffs portion of that comment. That is hard, harsh pushback today. What is your response to what the congressman had to say?
Well, I think that your clarification's important to amplify. The MBTA has not laid anyone off throughout this period. The cutbacks on the commuter rail, which is the place where we are currently seeing ridership at around 8 to 10%, and we think that the return to ridership there is going to be much slower and perhaps structurally changed. Is the one place where there have been furloughs. So, we think we've done a very prudent and transparent process of putting together these service cuts. Obviously, I hear the tape. I hear the congressman's strong objection to what we've done, and that's something we will obviously be talking to the delegation about. But I would say it is in service to stewarding the MBTA through this period where we've got a large structural deficit through as far as the eye can see, and by prudently conserving this money and spending it to deal with this, it gives us time to adapt to what is going to be a different type of ridership. Different levels of ridership in different places, and that's why we made the decision we did.
You ready to take another call?
Sure.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Ari on the line from Charlestown. Ari, you're on.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. We're obviously very concerned about costs right now. But the T is buying diesel buses for $1.8 million. That's actually $700,000 more than any other diesel bus that has ever been bought in the history of the country. And that's data from the American Public Transit Association. So I'm wondering why the T is so concerned about saving $20 million here, but the bus procurement process and the cost of vehicles just seems to be through the roof.
Okay, so what we can confirm as I take this back to MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak is an $89 million purchase of enhanced electric hybrid buses, 45 of them for the Silver Line in December. Just to put the numbers out that we know for sure for our listeners, Steve Poftak to respond to Ari.
Yes, I'd be happy to dig into this. These are hybrid buses, so they have both diesel and electric capability, which comes at a higher price point. But in my 6 years on the board, that price point has been pretty consistent. I'm happy to look into it, but I don't see that as extraordinarily different either from procurements we've done in the past or procurements that other properties have done.
So, Steve, we've done past, we've done present. I want to talk about future. We've talked a couple of times now, you and I, over the last few months about reinstating service if ridership goes up, about the structural future of the T and the T budget. How are you feeling about and thinking about a T of 2022 and beyond that not only recovers from what we've gone through, but can grow and develop with the economy we aspire to have as we come out of this pandemic here in Boston?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple parts to that. One is dealing with the challenge of sustainability for the T from a budgetary perspective. But I think then there's also building back service and building it back intelligently in places where it's needed. I think, if we've been taught anything by this pandemic, it has radically shown us where we are in essential service, where people are dependent on the MBTA. And I think that will inform our thinking going forward. I think one of the things we've said with these service cuts is we do intend to build the service back, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to build it back precisely the same way. We want to see how ridership returns and then build a system that serves these riders. So, I think some of the strategic planning that we're doing before the pandemic is actually going to inform that combined with ridership is going to inform where we add service back across the system.
So over the last year, you and I have also talked a lot on air about people being mad, right? We just heard it. People being mad about cuts to service, about the deficits and the steps that you're taking to try to address those, pushing back on you about your overall approach. And you talk with us openly when that comes. You don't always agree with that pushback. Others don't always agree with what you say in response. You're the leader of the MBTA. You care about transit. What is motivating you to be of service right now? And kind of what's your service motto day to day in this mix a year into this pandemic?
I mean, this pandemic has shown that the MBTA is an essential service. There's people who depend on us. The starkest example I can give is in April and May, sort of when we were at our lowest ridership levels, there were estimated 1,000 taps per day by seniors using the MBTA. If you think about the way most of your listeners, think about the way they lived their lives in April and May, it's clear that the folks who were seniors who were using the system needed it. They needed it to get to healthcare. They needed to get to the grocery store. So I think, what motivates me is serving our riders and serving our workforce, making sure that our workforce who's actually doing the work on the front lines has the tools that they need to get the job done and get it done safely. So I guess if I had to put it in a nutshell, it would be serving those two, I would say, very related groups, both our riders and our workforce.
That is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. Steve, thanks for checking in with us on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to continue to check in with those we've talked to last year, especially early on as the state started shutting down in earnest. We go next to essential workers, and we're going to continue to take your calls. Are you an essential worker, frontline worker? Do you feel essential? Has your community made you feel essential? How has your work changed over the last year? And if you are not employed now, what do you want of the new normal to be for you when it comes to work? Do you have hope of regaining your job? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So we welcome two guests back today. The first is Jose Lopes, who has worked at Stop and Shop in Brigham Circle for 38 years, and then Elizabeth Davis, a home care worker in Springfield, Greenfield, and Amherst. Jose, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me.
And Elizabeth, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jose, I think I'm going to start with you. I have to backtrack. It's wonderful to hear both of your voices. I'm really looking forward to catching up with you both now. So, Jose, I'll start with you. We talked with you first back in April about life on the front lines for essential workers like yourself. We were all still figuring out even what that was. And you described it at the time as going into the unknown. How have you been since then? And do you still feel like you're sort of navigating uncharted waters all the time?
Not anymore. Not as navigating unnavigable waters, but we are still in a precarious situation. We still worry about the disease every day, but it's not as bad as it used to be because it's been a year. So it's been a long time that we have to wear a mask.
And Elizabeth, when we talked to you last, you reminded us that you are yourself high risk. How have you been, and are you feeling more safe at all with your work? We just got a dial tone, so I wonder if we just lost one of our guests. Do I have you, Elizabeth? Okay, so we lost Elizabeth. That dial tone was Elizabeth, and everyone knows I really want her back because I can't wait to talk to her. So, Jose, we'll try to get Elizabeth back. I'm going to come back to you. Let's talk about being an essential worker. Everyone knows that there was a period last spring where essential workers were celebrated, despite not having enough PPE, despite working under really extreme conditions. Do you feel like we have ever fully recognized the risks that folks like you had to take every day over the last 365 days?
Not really. It's become a norm for people to just go in the stores and find people that work there. So no, they did recognize it, but as the time has gone on, it's gone back to a normal superstore, going to a store and shopping. It's just that you're wearing a mask and you're staying away from each other.
And what would recognition now feel like or look like for you, Jose? What would you want?
Well, not that I personally want anything particular. It's just I think that the government should recognize it. I think that people around us should recognize that we were very important to them at that particular time. And we normally are anyways, but it's just that we are under the radar usually.
So I do think we have Elizabeth back. Let me just put the phone number out real quick, 1-800-423-8255. If you're an essential worker, if you've been going in every day over this last year, if you share experiences with Jose and Elizabeth, call us and tell us your story. Again, 800-423-8255. So Elizabeth, let me bring you back again. When we talked with you, you told me that you are high risk yourself. Have you been feeling safe? Have you remained safe? And does it feel like it's turning a corner for you, or does work still feel risky every day?
No, I feel safe with it because our PPE has been coming to us overwhelmingly, I have to say, and that my coworkers, they all wear their PPEs. We are protecting our clients. And I'm so excited because of the vaccine that had came out and that it was approved. And I did get my vaccine, both my shots, and I am fully vaccinated. And my clients are fully vaccinated. But yet, when I go into the stores, I double mask because there's people that still refuse and wear their masks. And because of the variant that is out there. And another thing, too, is that I am being recognized as a frontline worker where in the beginning I wasn't. So now that I'm out there, I wear my badge, people recognize me and they thank me for all that I do. I'm feeling better. The tunnel is still long, but I can see a light at the end of the tunnel because I'm encouraging people to get fully vaccinated and that they should trust the science. And plus the black and the brown community, I urge them very, very much to trust science. Get vaccinated because our community is the one that got hit the hardest.
So I want to come back to Jose on essential workers and vaccinations in a minute. Elizabeth, I'm thrilled that you're feeling mm-hmm. safe and that you're vaccinated. That's great news. Also that the people that you work with are. We do have calls coming in. I want to grab a couple of caller thoughts here. We've got Bruce on the line. Bruce, I think you're on the road in Longwood. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Just fine, Bruce. Go for it.
Okay, great. So my name's Bruce. I'm a nurse. I'm in my car right now, and I travel around from nursing home to nursing home, starting IVs of different types, and I work in an ICU. I was listening to the radio because I'm in my car, and the mm-hmm. essential worker thing came up, and, you know, the medical people and other people, too, but medical people in my experience, you know, we've gone through a year of this whole thing, and the stress, the exposure to ourselves and to our families has been significant. And I'm a nurse. I get paid pretty well. I'd like to get paid more, but I look at myself and I also look at like the CNAs in particular that are right there on the front line, exposing themselves, taking chances on themselves and their family. And I don't see any compensation for this. I see posters and billboards and signs in front of buildings, but what about some stuff like compensation, like hazard pay, like no taxes for a year, like something along those lines that says, you know, you put yourself on the line, we should give you something back.
You know, Bruce, it's a great point. Thank you. Let me take it back from you there. Thanks for calling in, and thank you for doing your work, Bruce, over the last year. I do want to add one more voice here. Sasha in Dorchester. Sasha, go ahead.
Good afternoon. How are you? I just wanted to go back. I know we've moved past the tea topic, but I think it's important to tie it into being an essential worker and the question, do we feel essential? You know, and right now I'm not feeling very essential. You know, throughout this whole pandemic, I've been going into Boston and coming back every single day. And, you know, it's not just us. It's the people that operate the T's. We have the people that work the commuter rails and the buses and the subway systems. And I think it's extremely important to note how these service cuts are directly affecting us. And eventually when people do go back to work, when we hopefully see in some positive change in the next months or years or however long it takes. But I really think it's important that Steve Pofsek, general manager, and anybody else on the financial fiscal board that they have to sit down with these politicians that spoke today, like Stephen Lynch and Marty Walsh, and seriously discuss how they are impacting the people that they are supposed to be serving, and that is the people of Massachusetts and greater Boston. I can't
Thanks,
stress
Sasha.
That enough.
Thank you, Sasha. I'm going to take it back from you there. We're starting to lose your sound, but I feel like we got all your main points in there. Jose, do you mind do you take public transportation for work?
No, I don't.
Elizabeth, do you? Have either of you had to rely on it, Elizabeth?
No, I didn't have to rely on it.
All right. Well, Sasha gives us an important voice there then about the experience of doing essential work and riding the T. Thanks for that, Sasha. Jose, I'm going to come back. It's this question of appreciation, respect, realization of the dangers of your work. Delightfully, we heard that Elizabeth has been eligible and received a vaccination. Our grocery store workers are not yet. They are in phase two, but teachers have moved up in phase two. We're not done vaccinating people in the over 65 and comorbidities category. How have you felt about where your line of work stands in the vaccination plan?
Well, personally, I'm okay with it, but there's a lot of other people in the grocery business that work in the grocery areas that seem to think it's unfair. it's unfair that we've been out there since the start and continued the whole time, but yet we're being pushed back. The teachers are moving up because they're going back. Students are going back to school. We understand that, but it should be at least it should be been together. It should have been the frontline workers should be combined with the teachers, and so they can get that vaccine.
Elizabeth, now that you and the people that you serve are vaccinated, what is possible in how you do your work that wasn't in April or June or September?
I'm more at ease knowing that my clients are vaccinated, that their family members, like the little granddaughters, they can come, but their bigger adult children have not been able to come to visit the clients. So the families are still being separated. But I feel comfortable. It's more important that I get vaccinated because I'm the one who do the direct care for my clients. So it's essential for me to have been vaccinated. And, like, I wish that everybody could get vaccinated at one time, but it's not impossible. But I encourage everybody to keep wearing their mask. I'm still wearing mine, even though I am fully vaccinated. I'm not above getting coronavirus, but what it does, it helps me to not get seriously sick, not end up in a hospital, and not end up dying. And that's what the vaccination does.
Thank you for that, Elizabeth. And it's an important reminder for our listeners. Jose, so when all of our essential workers are vaccinated, and hopefully when we reach a point of herd immunity, what are you looking forward to going back to normal or returning to in your work at Stop and Shop?
Well, the foremost thing that I'm looking forward to is being without a mask. That's the most, I think, most exciting thing that's going to happen to us, that we don't have to focus on how to breathe, how, not to touch your mask, not to touch your face, washing your hand constantly, stuff like that. That's what I'm looking forward to.
All right, I'm going to grab one more call from another essential worker here. We've got Jill on the line in Burlington. Oh, we might have just lost Jill. Did I just lose Jill, control room? Okay, so we just lost Jill, but I will carry her point forward because Jill is a postal worker who wanted to remind folks that postal workers have also been working nonstop through all of this and feeling maybe like they're not being recognized for their work as well. Jose, I'm going to stay with you one more minute here and just ask you, if there's a listener today who would like to show some respect or gratitude to somebody who's been doing it day in and day out for all of us over the last year, what's one thing you would suggest that they could do, some small thing?
Well, I mean, a thank you is great, but show some respect show the distance, because people are getting lax if they're in the stores. They're crowding the stores. They're not actually doing what they should be doing, which is stay away from each other and give space. That's one of the most important things. But fortunately, a lot of people are wearing the mask, which is good, but spacing is not there.
And Elizabeth, you've really emphasized mask wearing, which Jose just did as well, and he told us about social distancing. Any other advice for listeners who want to show gratitude?
Yes, just keep wearing your mask, stay your distance, wash your hands, and recognize those who are essential. Let them know that you appreciate all that they do, because we come out there. We don't know whether we're going to return home well with our families. A lot of us are still separated from our families. We can't see our families because of the coronavirus. But I encourage everyone, even though you're vaccinated, please wear your mask, stay your distance, wash your hands until we can feel some type of normalcy. And my normalcy would be that I can get back up on a cruise ship and take my cruise.
Well, I will hope for that for you. Elizabeth Davis, a home care worker in Springfield, Greenfield, and Amherst. Jose Lopes, who has worked at Stop and Shop in Brigham Circle for 38 years. Elizabeth, Jose, I appreciate you. Thank you for what you're doing, and thanks for being on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We have been checking in today with members of our community who were affected deeply by the shutdowns that started a year ago this week. We're going to continue to take your calls on those shutdowns, your memories from when they started, your reflections on what they've meant for you. And we want to invite you to turn your attention now to dining in restaurants. Has your favorite restaurant survived, or are you mourning the loss of a favorite restaurant? When will you feel ready to return to in-person dining, or are you already there? Are you a restaurant owner? And if so, how's it going? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Irene Lee, owner and head chef of the May May Restaurant Group in Boston. We've checked in with her a few times over the last year. Irene, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Irene, last time we talked with you in October, you told us about a decision you had just made for May May to no longer exist as a traditional restaurant. You were going to transition to prepackaged food. How has that transition been, and how is your heart with that change?
Well, thank you so much for asking. I mean, my heart is sad in many ways. We ran the business for years and hoped to run it for many more. But transitioning to a packaged dumpling product has also been heartwarming in many ways, because our loyal fans are following us around to farmers markets. They're still coming by the restaurant for takeout to pick up lots of packs of dumplings. And so it's been a big shift, but I'm pretty happy with where we are right now.
So do you feel rallied around?
I really do. I think May May has always been a company with a personality. That's part of being a sibling-owned business with very sort of specific values and principles. And so folks who have shared those values with us have really been showing up. And, you know, we had a guest come pick up her food in the early weeks of the pandemic, and she stuck her head out her car window and said, "I love your values and I love your message and your food is good too." And so I thought, you know, okay, we're going to make it through this if people still feel so positively towards May May.
You know, that is all good news. It's toward the better and encouraging a year into the pandemic. One of our producers reached out to Bob Luz today, of the Massachusetts Restaurants Association. He estimates that 3,600 restaurants out of 16,000 in the Commonwealth have closed for good. He also says that about 97,000 jobs out of what was 301,000 as of the 1st of March last year have been lost. Are you seeing and feeling that around you, even as you've figured out how to keep May May going and had that kind of rallying from the people who support your food and your values?
Absolutely. The first thing that I should say is that we did lay off about 60% of our staff last summer, and that was the hardest thing I've ever done. We have also seen lots of other businesses take the same ultimately necessary steps. In some of my work with food insecurity as well, we're seeing the results of unemployment and lost hours, particularly for immigrant families, for folks who commute a long way to work, who are accustomed to working long hours and getting overtime in restaurants. They're having trouble paying their bills, putting food on the table as well. So the ripple effect is real in this case.
I'm going to go to the phones here, and listeners, 800-423-8255, how are you rallying around the local restaurant that you love, whose food you love, whose values you love? Call with your stories. John's on the line in Framingham. John, how about you?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. I just wanted to mention what I had done when the coronavirus started, was I started purchasing from various restaurants gift certificates. Because I knew that I wanted these restaurants to be there, because I know the great importance, seeing that I had went to a cook and baking school over 30 years ago and saw the great dedication that all the people that play into that for that plate of food that comes out, plus all the waitresses, all the hard and determined work that we do. So I said, I want to give back, knowing what I had to do so they could still continue having a job there by everyone just getting gift certificates everywhere. You know, that's a good start, I felt. And they praised me for doing that.
That's a great suggestion, John. Thank you so much. Irene, How, to what extent have steps like that, I think we all know people who are trying to order more takeout, buy gift certificates, make larger orders, eat out more frequently to try to help keep the restaurant industry going. What will now keep the industry going, and how do we keep restaurateurs and employees hanging on until we have more recovery?
Well, I think every little bit helps. And so we are grateful to every single guest who purchased a gift card or a cookbook or made a point of eating more dumplings. But of course, you know, those measures are not enough for the level of devastation that we're facing. Some of the opportunities for restaurants in the new relief bill are really exciting, and those are going to be hopefully at the scale that can really save businesses. I think, you know, every time someone bought a gift card, it felt like, oh man, people are thinking about us, and that means the world to us. But getting access to these grants and loans is what is really going to help us stay in business.
Yeah, let's stay on grants and loans for a minute. My understanding, and I want to check this with you, my understanding is that you did receive money from the Payroll Protection Program for May. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We've been extremely fortunate to be granted many of the opportunities that have been out there.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had two other restaurateurs on the show. One had received PPP money. The other, a Black restaurant owner of a tavern in Roxbury, tried but was unable to get it. What are the stories you're hearing across the restaurant community about who is and isn't getting the money? And it, from your perspective as, you know, an owner for this, this can be life or death. Is the government getting it right in general?
I think that the government has gotten it right with this most recent relief bill, which is going to take into account who has gotten PPP funding and who hasn't. So hopefully we'll be able to correct some of the very extreme inequities we saw. From my personal experience dealing with the PPP, it's very hard to imagine speaking English as a second language, not having a relationship with a bank, all of those things, you know, that helped me fill out all of that paperwork. And so it's very understandable that restaurant owners had a pretty uneven time of getting that support.
So Irene, one of the things that I've noted about you is that you actually yourself turned to service as the pandemic hit. First, you helped raise money for mom and pop businesses, immigrant-owned businesses. You led a grocery program for hospital workers. Why did you turn to service even as you were struggling, you know, to make sure that your own business was going to survive this?
I think in my gut, I felt that the only thing that would legitimate Maymay's continued existence is if we could be useful. And, you know, feeding people dumplings is useful on one level, but when there's so much suffering and so much need, it really felt imperative that we find a way to address that. And so that's where Project Restore Us came from. And, you know, we're all about feeding people. It doesn't have to be in our dining room. It doesn't even have to be our own food. If it's groceries, if it's prepared meals from other restaurants and we're supporting that, you know, that helped me cope on a personal level as well.
And now you're leading the Restaurant Resiliency Initiative at Commonwealth Kitchen. I've been over to Commonwealth Kitchen a number of times. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing over there.
So I've served on the board at Commonwealth Kitchen for a little over 4 years. And for folks who don't know, Commonwealth is Boston's first commissary and food business incubator with a big focus on building racial equity in our food system. Because of the pandemic, a lot of shifts have been made there. And one of the programs that is coming out is this pilot Restaurant Resiliency Initiative. It's a very intensive 16-week program where we're working with 8 Black and Latinx restaurant owners and operators. And what we're really aiming to do is put them in a position to thrive once COVID is over. This isn't about saving their businesses. They've done okay or even well during the pandemic, but we want to make sure that they're coming back even stronger with the skills that they need to expand, and so that the owners of the businesses can focus on growth and the long term, and not be, you know, trapped in the dish pit or behind the line. Working in the business versus on the business, I think, is a challenge for all small business owners, and in the restaurant industry, I think it's particularly hard.
And what have you learned in your years developing Maymay, if that's a fair way to put it, that you will teach these 8 restaurant owners so that they can, you know, kind of launch forward to the next level as we come out of this pandemic?
Well, there's a lot of curriculum, and we're working a lot on finances, building up people's comfort level with finances so that looking at the P&L can be useful rather than stressful.
Profit and loss, just for our listeners, exactly. Profit and loss statement, yeah.
Yeah, and we're also going to be doing a lot of work on menu design and making sure that all the different dishes on the menu are profitable, at least to some extent, and that the restaurant operators understand that. But I think, you know, it's not just about teaching. It's also about creating a space for them to ask questions, to commiserate with each other, and to sort of say, you know, I know what you're going through on some level, at least, and I have, you know, had the same worries and insecurities and questions. And I think the moral support in many ways is an equally big part of this program.
You know, everything that we've talked about just now, Irene, is serious. It's go, right? It's serve others. It's make sure the dumplings are produced, keep the business going. Do you see a moment coming anytime soon where you could pick your head up, eat some dumplings, maybe invent a new recipe, just step out of the day-to-day again?
Well, that's such a great question because I've been really, really fortunate to have an amazing team that is still on board at Maymay, and they have created this opportunity for me to step away from Maymay, at least in a part-time capacity, to get to work on the Restaurant Resiliency Initiative. I will be so forever grateful to them because this is my dream job. Getting to support and work with these business owners. And I do still eat a lot of dumplings, so don't worry about that. But I think, you know, it hasn't been easy to take a break and take a breath, but I feel so supported by, you know, our guests, my team. I think that this is the most energy I have had in about a year.
And what comes next for Maymay? Or what do you hope? Over the next 12 months, what do you hope comes next for Maymay?
Well, right now we are doing a little promotion, a product bundle. It's called Filled with Love and Made by Women. So for Women's History Month, we've compiled 6 products that are stuffed foods from around the world. So there's empanadas, tamales, pierogi, blintzes, and 2 kinds of dumplings. And we're having a lot of fun with that. We're getting to support all of these incredible woman-owned businesses. And all these foods are, of course, filled with love. And so we're continuing to think about how we get more dumplings out there and how we also help, you know, support and boost the other businesses who are doing similar things. When we made the pivot to farmers markets, we thought it was sort of hilarious that we always ended up in between, you know, a pierogi vendor and an empanada vendor. And we were just the alleyway of delicious stuffed foods, because at Maymay, we say dumplings make the world go round. Every culture has a delicious thing stuffed in a delicious thing. And so the more we thought about that, the more we think there's maybe a concept of some sort there, but hopefully the future includes lots more stuffed foods.
Okay, and I have to ask, just in a word or two, have you come across anything on the menus of these 8 restaurants that you're supporting that's kind of rocked your world, some food, that new food that you now love?
Well, I have tried the smoothies from Cafe Juice Up in Mattapan on Blue Hill Ave, and I don't think I had ever had soursop before. But, you know, they're not your typical juice bar. They have so many different ingredients available, many Caribbean flavors that are new to me, at least. And so it's been really fun to just explore what they're doing and to sort of see a different iteration of the juice and smoothie bar.
What a nice shout out. All right. That is Irene Lee, owner and head chef of the Maymay Restaurant Group in Boston. Irene, thanks for checking back in with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for today, everyone. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. So glad you joined us. Do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.